Imagine that your present boss comes to you one day, and if you don't have an employer now, just imagine or think back to the time that you did have an employer, and he or she says to you, "I'm going to be gone for a year, and here's what I want you to work on while I'm gone, and it starts tomorrow." How do you feel that next day when you go in and the boss isn't there? And you know that he or she isn't going to be there for a whole year. Well, you feel relaxed, at ease. You maybe even put your feet up on the desk. You might actually eventually have to push against a very lackadaisical attitude, even laziness. But you'd feel free of his or her constraint. Now imagine the year is almost up, and you look up at the calendar and you realize you got 3 days left and the boss is coming back. How do you feel then? You don't feel lazy. You feel highly motivated. Man, you are focused. And you're pushing small things out of the way, and all of a sudden your priorities have gotten very, very clear in your mind. You've had a whole year, and now the day of reckoning is right around the corner. Will your boss be pleased or not pleased by your work? Well, that's a small analogy to the New Testament's teaching on the second coming of Jesus Christ, our boss, if we have taken him to be our Savior and Lord. That's what he is to us, our boss, our master. And we, his servants, who are to do what he asks us to do. Now, that analogy of a master and servant or master and slave is at least a little offensive to most of our modern ears, whether you're here this morning as a non-Christian or even as a Christian. Master servant, master slave, the master speaks, the servant slave does what he says. But this is an analogy that Jesus thinks really illuminates something about us and about him. So bear with him, and let's look together again at this text that we started on 2 weeks ago in Matthew 24. As we look at it today and one more week next week, if you've got a pew Bible, it's on page 1538, and this is going to be a tough sermon to listen to if you don't have a text of Matthew 24 in front of you. So look on. Those of you who brought your Bibles, share the pew Bibles. But as you listen to Jesus' teaching here, look for him to answer four questions for us, and we won't be able to finish them today, but the first one is simply the question of what's going to happen? What's the plot for the last chapter of the story of the world? What's going to happen? That's the first question. The second question is, what should I be careful about? As a disciple of Jesus Christ, what should I be watching out for? The sense of being aware of a danger. And the third question is, what should I be expecting as a disciple of Jesus Christ? What should I be expecting from God, from other people? And the last question is, what should I actually be doing with and in my life? It's the first three verses of Matthew 24 as we begin. Jesus left the temple and was walking away when his disciples came up to him to call his attention to its buildings. Their beauty, their glory. It was an incredible building architecturally and aesthetically. "Do you see all these things?" Jesus asked. "I tell you the truth, not one stone here will be left on another. Everyone will be thrown down." He's predicting the destruction of the temple, which was coming. As Jesus was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately. "Tell us," they said, "when will this happen? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" Jesus is going to answer this first question. What's going to happen? What's basically the plot in this last chapter of the story? And I said to you 2 weeks ago that in the midst of great controversy among serious Christians who have a very high view of the Bible, there's a lot of difference of opinion, but in the midst of all of that, the work of two students of the New Testament, David Wenham and Don Carson, are the ones that seem to me to make the most sense out of the text. And we said that in their view, verses 4 through 14, in these verses, Jesus is giving his disciples and us the big picture of the last chapter of history. It began with Jesus' ascension, the last chapter did. Jesus ascended on high and sat down on the throne of David at his Father's right hand. And this last chapter ends with his return. And their argument is, and others hold this as well, that the disciples were confused when they came and they said, "Well, when will this happen? What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" The confusion was that they thought the destruction of the temple and Jesus' final coming to mop everything up, as it were going to be back to back, one right after the other. And Jesus corrects them here first by giving an overview of the whole of the last chapter. Verse 4, "Watch out," Jesus answered, "that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, claiming, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of birth pains. Then you will be handed over to be persecuted and put to death, and you will be hated by all nations because of me. At that time, many will turn away from the faith and will betray and hate each other. And many false prophets will appear and deceive many people. Because of the increase of wickedness, the love of most will grow cold. But he who stands firm to the end will be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come." You see, that's a picture of the whole sweep of history, from Christ's ascension all the way to the end until his coming. Now what we get in verses 15, only through verse 21, Carson and Wenham suggest, we get sandwiched in here Jesus' prediction about the destruction of the temple. The destruction of the temple as a fierce breaking in history, a fierce breaking in of the final judgment which is to come. That great judgment that takes place at the end of history when every human being will stand before the Lord Christ. And so verse 15 starts, "So when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." You see, now he's talking about something local there in Palestine, in Judea. "Let no one on the roof of his house go down to take anything out of the house. Let no one in the field go back to get his cloak. How dreadful it will be in those days for pregnant women and nursing mothers. Pray that your flight will not take place in winter or on the Sabbath." Jesus anticipates that the Sabbath law will still be in force. "For then there will be great distress," or tribulation, as some translations have it, "unequaled from the beginning of the world until now, and never to be equaled again." The Jewish historian Josephus tells us that 1 million people were killed when the Roman general Titus came in 66 AD and for 4 years besieged the city and essentially starved it out, and then stormed the gates when someone inside the city betrayed the city and the Romans came in. Well, the suggestion is that then in verse 22, now Jesus is going back to the larger picture. If those days, that is those days of distress that Jesus has begun to describe here in verse 4 that go all the way from the ascension, all the way to his return, if those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. At that time, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect, if that were possible. See, I have told you ahead of time. Now, the objection, of course, is to say, well, isn't this sort of arbitrary that right here at verse 15, now Jesus changes the subject? And isn't it also arbitrary to hold that he's ending his discussion of the destruction of the temple at verse 21? It seems kind of arbitrary. There's no indication that Jesus is changing now and starting to talk about something different. Well, in response to that, if you look at verse 14, it does seem as if Jesus has come to the end of something. The gospel, the good news of Christ, will be preached in all places of the world, and then the end will come. You see, that's sort of a marker there. Then the end will come. So he's gone from the beginning in their time all the way to the end. So there is a kind of marker here between verses 14 and 15. Remember this too, that the New Testament was not divided into verses as we know it until the 1500s. In fact, in the manuscripts that were used in the early centuries, there's no spaces even between the words. The context enabled you to figure out where there was a new thought. So that's the suggestion, that verses 4 through 14 describe the whole world and what will characterize this last chapter of redemptive history. And then verses 15 through 21 describe something that's going to take place in Judea, in Jerusalem. And Jesus seems to be alluding here in verse 15 either to the temple, so when you see in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation, spoken of through the prophet Daniel, and maybe an allusion to the temple. It's possible to take Matthew's words here, standing in the holy place, as simply a description of Israel as a holy land, because God had marked it out for himself. But here in these verses, the suggestion is Jesus is now answering their question about the destruction of the temple. And as I said, for 4 years, the Roman general Titus besieged the city of Jerusalem, and it was terrifying. Well, what does this mean here in verse 15, the allusion to Daniel? 4 times, I think it is, in the book of Daniel, we find this phrase, the abomination of desolation. So when you see standing in the holy place, the abomination of desolation, or in the NIV, the abomination that causes desolation, what does that mean? Well, almost all students of the book of Daniel believe that in the book of Daniel, when Daniel is predicting the abomination of desolation which is to come, he's talking about Antiochus Epiphanes, a pagan ruler who with his armies invaded Israel in 168 BC. And to show his utter contempt for Judaism, he first made it a capital offense, a capital crime, to worship the God of Abraham. And then, sacrilege upon sacrilege, he went into the Holy of Holies, or rather into the holy place where the altar of burnt offering was, and he built over that an altar to Zeus. And then he sacrificed the pig on the altar to Zeus. And you'll remember that a pig is an unclean animal in the Old Testament law. That was an abomination of desolation. We also know from history that the Roman Emperor Caligula, in the year 38 AD, after Jesus' ascension, tried to set up a statue of himself as the divine being in the temple in Jerusalem. But the way Jesus puts it here, so when you see standing in the holy place the abomination that causes desolation spoken of through the prophet Daniel, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountain. So the suggestion seems to be that when the Christians see the abomination of desolation, they are to leave. Mark's gospel has here in this part of the text, when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it ought not. And Luke has paraphrased it, and Luke simply translates, he doesn't use the word abomination of desolation or that phrase. He says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. There's an old and important manuscript that doesn't have the words actually standing in the holy place. And the suggestion is that what Jesus is referring to here is the Roman armies as they would come with their ensign, the Roman standards carrying the flag and the big golden eagle, and then the image of the emperor who was regarded as divine. When you see that coming, then flee, because judgment is about to break in. Now, some argue that the judgment against Jerusalem and the fall of the temple doesn't end with verse 21, but in fact goes all the way from verse 15 to verse 35. So that this whole section here, immediately after the distress of those days, which is verse 29, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. At that time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds from one end of the heavens to another. If you think there's no break between verse 21 and verse 22, then you are forced to the conclusion that what follows here, what I just read, is a description of the destruction of Jerusalem, the Son of Man coming with clouds and with the sound of a trumpet, and the angels go out and gather the elect. You're forced to say that that is a description of Christ coming somehow in judgment to destroy those who had opposed him, because they refused to acknowledge that the focal point had changed with his coming from the temple now to him as the only mediator between God and man, and his death as the only sacrifice that was sufficient to cover the guilt of our sin. But it does seem to many that this is a forced interpretation of this idea of you'll see the Son of Man coming in the sky, that there will be a trumpet call. That's what the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15. That's what he says in 1 Thessalonians 4 when he's talking about Christ coming at the end. This seems rather to be better interpreted that with verse 22, now Jesus returns to his earlier theme of describing the whole period between his ascension and his return. It's marked by trouble and tribulation. But now also, Jesus seems to be implying that there will be an intensification of persecution against God's people at the end of the last chapter of history. Look at verse 22. If those days had not been cut short, no one would survive. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be shortened. That seems to imply an intensification of what he has described earlier, beginning with verse 4, that this last chapter is going to be marked by trouble, and it's going to be marked by difficulty, and it's going to be marked by opposition to Christ. And then go back to verse 8. Jesus is saying the world is going to continue to be in pain and turmoil and tumult. There's going to be wars. There's going to be earthquakes. There's going to be fire and famine. All these things are going to continue. And then in verse 8, he says, but all these are the beginning of birth pains. Well, think about labor. It intensifies. You can see it. Contractions begin more mildly, then they intensify as the labor goes on. So Jesus seems to be implying that while this whole age is characterized by hostility to Christ and to his message of exclusivity, that he is the only way to God, that nevertheless there will be an intensification at the end. Well, then in verses 23 and following, he goes back again to the theme of watchfulness. At that time, or then, which the ESV has, is probably a better translation, he goes back to what he has said earlier about false claims. Then if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it, for false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect. If that were not possible, see, I've told you ahead of time. So if anyone tells you, there he is, out in the desert, do not go out. Or here he is, in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. Wherever there is a carcass, there the vultures will gather. That's a very difficult proverb that Jesus seems to invoke here, difficult to understand precisely what he means, but the image before that is crystal clear. As lightning that comes from the east is visible even in the west, so will be the coming of the Son of Man. It will be impossible not to know that this is him returning. And so what does Jesus say? He goes back to this theme of don't be taken in by imposters. Make no mistake, it will be impossible not to know when I come again. And then in the verses that follow, in verses 29 all the way through verse 44, Jesus describes his return. That's at the end of the end of the last chapter of history, and how we will know that in fact it's near. Immediately after the distress of those days, that is when the time of trouble that has gone from the ascension to the end, when that is finished, then he will come, and the sun and moon will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the heavenly bodies will be shaken. It's from Isaiah. Jesus is coming back, and nature itself will presage, as it were, the severe judgment that is to come on the world. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky. And the sign is not one sign that belongs to the Son of Man, but the sign that is the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory, and he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near, or he is near. Perhaps it can be translated, right at the door. I tell you the truth, this generation will certainly not pass away until all these things have happened. Heaven and earth will pass away, But my words will never pass away. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be taken in the field. It's not clear whether the one taken is taken in judgment or taken to be redeemed, but a distinction is being made. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill. One will be taken and the other left. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. How easy it was then, how easy it has been since then to get so preoccupied with all of the signs of the end. And Jesus will really have none of it here. He says these are going to be the signs. That the trouble and pain of the world is going to go on, that the persecution of God's people is going to characterize this whole age. Those are the signs of my coming. And the disciples saw that, for sure. They also lived to see the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, at least most of them probably. This generation that he was speaking to saw that. But Jesus wants to underscore, nobody knows when it's coming. In fact, he says here, it's going to be like the days of Noah. He's going to come when you don't expect him. It's not that you get all of your calculations right, and once you have all the calculations right, then he's coming. No, there is to be this readiness. When we see all of these things going on all through these 2,000 plus years, we as God's people are supposed to be ready and thinking of him as right at the door. Now that, friends, is the plot. That's the outline. Jesus wanted his disciples to know that. And he wants us to know the rough outline of the plot. There'll be intense opposition to me, Jesus says. You will be hated all on my account. In verse 9, and that will intensify at the end. And these age-old wounds of the world, war, famine, earthquake, fire, flood, that will also be a sign of my coming. And that will continue. But so will a sign of my coming be that the good news goes into the whole world. The good news will be preached everywhere, Jesus says here, and then the end will come. So when you see the good news going out, that's a sign that I'm coming. And then at the very end, there will be this dramatic return. I will come. I will not leave the world in its pain. I will not leave you with the world opposing you. I will come and I will rescue you and I will vindicate you. And oh yes, there's going to be in between there this slice of divine judgment against Israel for turning away from me, and the temple will be destroyed. Now that's what's going to happen. That's the plot. But the second question is, what should I be careful about as a disciple of Jesus Christ? What should I be careful about? In other words, where might I be deceived because I'm not being careful? What danger should I be watching out for? Look at verse 4. Watch out. Be careful. There's a danger. And look what he says in verses 23, 24, and 25. If anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will appear and perform great signs and miracles to deceive even the elect. if that were possible. See, I've told you ahead of time, so don't be tricked. That's Jesus' point here. If we are true followers of Jesus, we are always to be watching out for. We are always to have our antenna up for. We are always to be guarding against false claims of messianic power, the false claims of prophets. We said 2 weeks ago that if the 20th century prophet Carl Sagan is right, who taught that salvation came from science, there is no afterlife, the only salvation we know is in the here and now. But if the prophet Carl Sagan was right, then Jesus is wrong. Jesus can't be right. If Muhammad, the 7th century prophet, is right, Jesus can't be right. Because Muhammad came and said that he had a revelation from God, and in this revelation from God, there is no need for atonement. Jesus never even died in crucifixion. Jesus' ministry was incomplete. That's why God was sending him. Well, friends, if Muhammad is right, Jesus can't be. If Jesus is right, Muhammad can't be right. Now, this watchfulness that is supposed to mark our lives as believers has enormous implications for us. A couple of things it doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that you and I are supposed to cultivate an attitude of paranoia toward others. Somebody's always out to get me. The New Testament knows of persecution that comes to us because we are not doing it right. We are not to be paranoid. We are not to cultivate a hostility towards other people, because Jesus so emphatically says here that it is possible to be deceived, that many will come, that many will oppose us. We're not supposed to cultivate a hostility. Someone should not be able to say about Christians what someone said once in a spoof on English history, that the Roundheads were right but repulsive. That's not supposed to be who we are. Too many Christians down through the ages have been way too mean-spirited because they took up this theme of the opposition to Christ and watch out for false prophets and false messianic claims will come. And they've simply been mean-spirited. Now, what does Jesus call us to? He says, be innocent as a dove, but as shrewd as a snake. And the Apostle Paul, what did he say? He said, I become all things to everybody in order that I might win some. What does that mean? That means that he tries to establish a rapport with people, that he comes onto their level, that he sees himself as one of them, and he builds whatever human bridges he can to them. Why? Because he knows that God is drawing men and women and boys and girls to himself through the power of love. Some of you who know the Prairie Home Companion might remember a time when Garrison Keillor described his own upbringing in a church that was preoccupied with false doctrine. And he said they were trained always to smell the burning rubber of error. If that is the only thing that characterizes us, we're in trouble. We should be reaching out to those who deny that there is a God. We should be reaching out to Muslims. We are on the same level as they are, friends. And if you don't believe that, then you have not understood the grace of the kingdom of God. You see who Jesus is truly, the final prophet, if you see him as Lord and Savior only. Because God has opened your eyes. We should be weeping for Muslims who don't know Christ, for our pagan neighbors who don't know Christ. For people everywhere who don't know Christ. And doing whatever we can, we will come to that. Because this gospel, this good news of love, is to go into the high world. You want to know what you should be watching out for? What is a danger? False teaching. False claims. Outside the church and also inside the church. Because they often come from inside the church. The Apostle Paul made that very clear when he gave his parting speech to the Christians at Ephesus, to the elders. He said, watch out, because from within your own congregations, wolves in sheep clothing are going to come. You can't just kick back and say, well, I got a whole year. I got a whole year before the boss shows up. No, here it is. Be ready. And yeah, even 2,000 years later, and he hasn't come back, this is the word. Be ready. He is right at the door. Be watchful, because there is so much that is false. And so we'll end just with Jesus' exhortation here in verse 44. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. At least the boss says, I'm coming back on such and such a day, and you know I got 3 days. But what Jesus teaches here is that no one will expect him when he comes. So be ready always. Whether it's the year 50 AD or whether it's the year 2009, more than 2 millennia after Christ, be ready, because he's coming.